Okay, folks, we're recording. So is everybody in their seat? Okay, I'd like to call the HPC February 27th, 2018 to open the meeting. Bear with me a second, I'm gonna get my screen's frozen. Okay, well, I called it to order. Brent, could you take roll call, please?
Spalnick?
Here.
Mylander?
Here.
Bodover?
Here.
Edie?
Here.
Carlson?
Here.
Pisomas?
Here.
Fulmer?
Here.
Romanos?
Here.
Romanos?
Here.
And Schultz?
Here. Brent, thank you. Next on the agenda is setting the agenda. And before I call for a motion, I'd like to suggest a couple of things. The future, Brent, you've done a great job preparing the packet, and the packet is numbered through the packet, but the agenda doesn't have the page numbers on it at which each of these points start. So if you're dealing with a full packet and you're looking at the agenda, it would be really helpful to have page such and such to such and such.
Okay.
If that's, I mean, it seems to me that's probably reasonable to do.
Yeah, I didn't either. Than what I usually do.
Oh, I know. I've been thinking about it, and it's particularly important when the packet is large.
Yeah.
And some of the names are confusing, so it's a little hard to keep parsing through it. And
you mean on the agenda portion?
On the agenda portion,
okay.
If you put the sections.
That it automatically populates the agenda, so I don't think you can go in and add page numbers to the agenda portion, the agenda page.
Well, maybe there's just a second sheet that lists all the items that are in the packet and gives you the page numbers for those.
I'll look at that, and I won't guarantee that it can be done, but I'll look at that.
And I understand that. If it can be done in some simple way, I think it would help members going through large packets. But with that said, do I have a motion or a motion with amendments to the agenda as proposed?
So moved.
Do I have a second?
I'll second it.
Moved by Valerie, seconded by Mark Carlson. Moved by who?
Jamie.
Moved by Jamie, seconded by Mark Carlson. I apologize. Is there any discussion? All right. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Any opposed? All right. Motion carries unanimously. The third item is the open forum. And Brent, could you please summarize the public speaking guidelines for the public that is here and would like to speak?
The public forum is available for members of the audience to address HPC members. Each speaker is limited to 4 minutes in length, and the HPC will allow for about 15 minutes of open comment period during their meetings.
Anyone wish to speak?
That's kind of large to show it on the screen, so if I just ask if you lay it against a chair.
John Kriesel, 22 3rd Street Southwest, Rochester, Minnesota. I'm here to touch on the topic of the historic district. At least in my mind, I do not understand why to limit the scope of the historic district. As I understand it, there's a dialogue relative to not extending beyond 4th Street Southwest. I brought this little piece about what we once had as Mail Park. Okay. I'm also going to bring up that public land is priceless. It's not to be consumed in further developments. I myself would like to see the historic district extend further south. I see no reason why I couldn't include the Ram Barns, maybe all the way to the fairgrounds. I do not understand why the historic district cannot go further east to incorporate Mayo Park. It would suggest that it would go up to Circle Drive north. Then we have the ability to discuss matters. Now, before demolition permits. Regarding 4th, or south of 4th, we all know that the Moss and McAndrews building has become a poster child for our community. The Moss and McAndrews building, I think most people do not understand the significance of the Moss and McAndrews building. The Moss and McAndrews building, out of that building came the foot operated and elbow operated valves for surgeons, as well as the aspirator, as well as that is where the centrifuge was built at the Moss McAndrews building. So it's one could say the contributions to the city of Rochester go beyond other single contributions, even that of now that we demolished the 14 building, the 28 building. I would like to mention to you that the first engineer ever for the Mayo Clinic was Fred Moss. When Dr. Charlie and Will went to Ernest Moss and said, "Ernest, great job with the 1914 building. Are you interested in providing all the plumbing, heating, and HVA for our next building?" "Sure, be happy to." That was Charlie and Will directing it to Fred Moss. They said, "We'll give you that job under one condition, that Fred engineers that building for us and he becomes our engineer." Fred Moss was the first engineer hired by the Mayo Clinic and stayed as their engineer well into the 1960s. So the significance of south of 4th Street, that should include the Moss McAndrews building, goes without saying. As I understand it also, I don't quite understand, John, why we would not include Riverside building.
I need to ask Brent a question. I apologize. Or maybe it's for Pat. We are not having a public hearing on the landmark district. So I was going on the basis for someone to speak about that in the open comment period makes sense, because they may not have a chance to speak during the meeting. Is that the read you would take of it?
What I have heard historically is it's to comment on items that are not on the agenda is fair for the open forum. And so, yes.
Yes, I can speak.
That's my understanding.
And that was, I just wanted to check so it didn't come back to bite us. All right.
Well, to clarify, so we're going to be viewing a draft of the downtown district. So is it fair? I mean, will there be comments? So, okay.
It's not a public meeting.
We're not making a decision on this.
Right, we're not making a decision.
If we were making a decision, we'd have a time for public comment.
And that's absolutely correct, because it's not.
So therefore, this now is the time for me to speak.
Yes, so please.
Now, as I understand.
Did you say the time,
Brett? A minute left.
Okay.
I would like to also ask this. I'm just gathering information. Our PVN consultants, I don't know if there's a representative here tonight. Thank you. Nice to have you here.
We'll introduce you later.
what was their suggestion as it relates to south of 4th Street, and are your suggestions? That's one question. And would it include, if you are not talking about south of 4th Street, I would like to know why specifically the Riverside or the Moss McAndrews building would not be part of that district. That's direct. Bless you. Anything? Any questions at all?
Any questions for Mr. Kreisel?
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Is there anyone else who would care to speak during the open forum period? Going once? Going twice? You can't fake us out like that, you know?
All in.
Take a couple minutes to get the machine ready for it, but
okay.
I mean, I can get it ready if you want me to, but
okay, I just wanted to make sure.
you want, you can probably start talking and show the picture at the meeting. All right. Is that okay? Or?
My name is Sean Kettlecamp, and I live at 232 7th Avenue in Rochester, Southeast. And my question, I guess, and my thing that I want to speak to, I guess, kind of goes a little bit along with what John Kriesel was talking about, where there was a map that was put in the newspaper that laid out an historic district, and what I wanted to know was how come some of these things, I mean, and it was just put in the newspaper 6 months ago or 8 months ago, and now all at once it seems like it's different, and people are surprised that there's not as many buildings on there that they thought, that the, I think John maybe misspoke and thought, rather than go to the Circle Drive, it would go up to Civic Center Drive and go down to, you know, farther south than what it shows in the picture that was in the newspaper. And some of the things that are on there are suddenly not on there, including the Time Movie Theater and the Red Owl Grocery Store. And I wanted to know why those things weren't included anymore.
It's good for you to bring those up. And again, when our consultant comes up, I think that she's taking notes.
And that not only, they're the historic district picture for us. Because it also doesn't include the train station, the Great Western train station, now Porch and Cellar Restaurant. My thinking is it leaves out a lot of stuff. It doesn't go, it should go up to the Civic Center Drive.
We have the screens here in front of us. Okay. We can see what you're looking at.
We don't have to turn around.
Okay. So and we're looking at all the green spots there. And so it's kind of skimpy. And that's what I wanted to make sure everybody got to see.
Does anyone have any questions for Ms. Kettlecamp?
All right. Questions about the historic district as it's shown there.
It will be interesting to hear the conversation between the commission and the consultant. Mm-hmm. All right. Would anyone else care to help speak? Teresa, would you like to come up to here, or you're going to stay there? I think the rule is you speak one time, and your 4 minutes did run out. Mm-hmm. All right, I'm going to call that then, and we're going to close the forum. Moving on to the next item on the agenda, it's minutes, approval of the minutes from January 23rd, 2018. Before I look to other commissioners to comment on this, I have two comments that I'd like to make. Teresa McCormick, who just came in, is an ex officio member. She represents the Olmsted County History Center, or History Center of Olmsted County, however you do the acronym. And because she does not live in city limits, she cannot be a voting member on the commission because of the way our ordinance is written. But I noted in the minutes that it's not noted when she's there, and she's there during a discussion and there's a vote. And I believe she should always be documented in the minutes as attending. Brent, so on the voting, she'd be present but not voting. And then also she's recognized for her role with the History Center, because she is the only, in our ordinance, that membership is the only one that's called out specifically in the ordinance. So I appreciate her being on it in a time when she's non-voting based on the ordinance rules, but participates in very productive ways.
Madam Chair?
Yes.
I just asked if she could move to a spot where she'd be able to have a microphone.
Yeah.
And I would encourage all the members to have the microphone near you if you're making a comment. I did review the tape from last meeting, the 3.5 hours, and some people's voices were really hard to pick up.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Thank you, Pat. In that same vein, I reviewed part of the tape, not the whole thing. And I noted that the commission, we as commissioners, and I'm guilty of it myself, we tend to speak over each other. We tended not to always wait until recognized by the chair. And there are some parts that are hard to understand because we're in conflict. So I'd like to say from this night forward, let's work really hard to wait until one person is completely finished and you are then recognized by the chair before you say anything. And if I'm not doing an appropriate job, let me know, because you can help me do this better too. Staff, I would also ask to speak up. In what I listened to, Brent and Pat were frequently very hard to hear. So it might behoove everybody to just take, 15 minutes to listen to that and sort of see how it goes, and then I think you'll understand we need to do better. All right, on the minutes from January, do I have a motion or motion with amendments?
I did hand off some revised minutes.
These are revised?
Yeah, yes. I added under the set the agenda portion, I added a link to where the audio can be found.
To where what can be found?
The audio of the minutes. Audio of the minutes. And then on page 5, that first paragraph, it says June 2000. That should be June 2017, so that was corrected.
Yeah. Okay. Thank you, Brent. So what we are reviewing now is the minutes as amended, corrected by Brent, which you all have in front of you. Have each of you had a chance to look through it? Anybody need a minute? Okay. Do I have a motion to approve or a motion to approve with amendments?
I'll make that motion.
I have Mark Carlson making the motion. Do I have a second? Seconded by Trent. Do I have any discussion?
I have a question. On the front of the page, it says that Trent was present. And then when you turn the page for consent agenda new business, Trent is absent. So I wasn't here as I was absent, but I guess I'm trying to figure out how we can be present and absent at the same time.
On page 3, there's a note. It says that he arrived at 5:25. So.
Yeah.
Thank you.
That's a good question. Thank you, Dan.
Thank you.
Since Dan's here, I'd also like to ask, if someone is not present, should they abstain from voting on minutes, or?
Typically, if someone's not here, they don't vote on something to say whether it's correct or not.
Right. Does that make sense? Okay. But he asked the good questions. Okay, I have a motion and a second. Any further conversation? All in favor of minutes as amended by Brent and with the one correction, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Any opposed? Motion carries unanimously. Brent and Pat, before we go on, if you could introduce us to city staff members who are here, who are new to the commissioners, so that we understand who's attending this meeting. Pleasure to meet you.
Next to Pat's right is Aaron Parrish. He is the assistant city administrator number 2. He's taking Gary Newman's position.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Most of you know Mr. Johnson, who's the director of Rochester Civilian and Safety Department.
Yeah,
he's
okay.
He's always
been to plenty of meetings.
Administrator number 2 is that second to it's Steve Reimer and then the new Aaron, which I'm sure you're going to get tired of being called the new Aaron.
Chair members of the commission, yeah, it's confusing in our office because we have a new Steve and a new Aaron. And,
yeah.
So that was not intentional, of course, but actually Terry Spaeth has assumed Aaron Reeves' former position, and I'm going to be assuming Gary Newman's
Gary
position.
Newman, yeah.
And so, yeah, I'm from the, I guess, the second to the city administrator, Reimer. That being said, we're kind of evaluating our roles and responsibilities within admin, and so we hope to be able to kind of determine who's got what portfolios in the coming months.
That makes sense. And just briefly before we move off of this, can you tell us where you came from?
Chair of the Commission, again, Aaron Parrish. I started on February 1st. I was previously the city administrator of the city of Forest Lake, which is on the northern edge of the Twin Cities. And I was there for about 7 years. And prior to that, I was the city administrator in Kirkston, which is in northwest Minnesota.
Thank you. Jason?
Chair, I was deputy city attorney in Portland, Oregon. I was also a city attorney in Laramie, Wyoming, and Portland.
All right, thank you very much. Okay, moving on within our agenda. Under old business, we have the draft downtown commercial historic district for review tonight, and that's pages 7 through 90 within your packet. I'm going to ask if everyone has noted that there was a change in boundaries. Were you all able to review the memo from PBN? Okay.
And Madam Chair, did you get an assent from most people from nods and heads?
I didn't get anything, so I should call for something more vocal.
And just acknowledge that they've read materials or not and need more time.
Okay. Well, it was within the packet. The one memo was. So I trust everyone had reviewed it, but if anyone needs time, okay. So, yes, I'll get more affirmation next time. I think it would make sense if we would have our consultant introduce herself and give us an introduction. And this is relatively new to us. And I, at least, will be looking for a fairly detailed overview to help us dive into it. And what that means to you and what that means to us, we'll find out as you go.
My name is Tamara Lute with Preservation Design Works, or PVN. Do you want my business address? Okay, 575 Southeast 9th Street, Minneapolis. Madam Chair and Commission, PVN did draft a downtown commercial historic district designation study, and I've heard some really excellent questions, and I think when I see a difference between downtown designation study and downtown commercial historic district designation study, that's going to hit on some of the answers that those questions will need as a response. So what PVN did was we actually conducted two site visits, and we were given parameters by City of Rochester staff, Aaron Reeves, who's no longer here, as buildings that we should look at. And there was a district that was examined for National Register eligibility by a previous consultant. And so that set some pretty good boundaries for a commercial historic district for us to begin looking at, and we did not stick with those boundaries, but that was our starting point. Now, it's important to note that National Register eligibility is really different from local designation eligibility on a number of parameters. Local designation can often have a different assessment of integrity. National Register eligibility depends on a fairly high degree of integrity. It can shift a little bit for a district that integrity is measured across a district as a whole rather than for an individual building where the expectation is very high. For a local district, local HPCs and local city staff determine what a measure of integrity is. Integrity, for those of you who don't know, is a building's ability to convey its historic significance through ultimately historic materials. We can have a conversation about when a building's socially significant, if that makes sense, but that is usually the measure that we use. So we actually walked downtown Rochester several times to get a sense of what buildings we thought stood out as being highly intact or seeming to say, like, hey, look at me, I have a story to tell. And from there, we began examining the historical record, building permits, Sanborn maps, city maps, city histories, and the things that we could find to develop a history of downtown Rochester's commercial core. And I think that's the key part here, which is that when we establish boundaries that told us something about the commercial development of this city, not the medical development, not the agricultural development, not the residential development, but we stuck really tightly to commercial development. And so that does dictate boundaries a little bit, because one of the things that we have to consider as a historic consultant for you, for the city, for someone, for a certified local government who has to take a proposed district and submit it to the State Historic Preservation Office for their review, is that boundaries can't look, and I've really struggled with a word, the word that looks best is gerrymandered, like they have donuts in them. So if they're creatively drawn, that raises a lot of red flags at the State Historic Preservation Office. So when buildings are asked to be removed from the historic district, and there were a couple of buildings for a number of reasons that the city had asked us to take out of the district, and I think that's for city staff to speak to, that...
Which buildings those are by name?
I have to get my list, though, to make sure I...
Could she also indicate which... Wait, can I ask a question?
Yeah.
Barry,
you asked a quick question.
Barry, you have to be recognized before you can speak. All right, and I'm going to let her answer my question before you, please.
Thanks, everyone. Okay, so the buildings that were removed were, or buildings or parcels, I should be clear. 11th, 4th Street Southeast.
You're going to have to give names.
I don't know the name of 11th, 4th Street Southeast, because we deal with addresses, because over time buildings have any number of names.
That's the Riverside building.
That is the Riverside building. And then 400 Broadway, which I understood was called 400 Broadway, right? For a while? Okay. And an adjacent parcel at, and a neighboring parcel at 14th 4th Street, which is Matthew McAndrews, correct?
Correct.
And Matthew McAndrews was part of the district until 400 Broadway came out, and then we had a lone building down at the quarter. It does start to look like, from a consultant's perspective, that I have sort of raked your boundaries. Now, that being said, the commission can make recommendations in most instances on what they want included, but the recommendations that I have to make for you have sort of clear boundaries. And clear boundaries, once we remove 400 Broadway, really do come to 4th Street.
Could we bring...
Excuse me, I had the next... I just wanted to know, you said the city staff asked you to remove... Which city staff specifically asked you to remove the buildings?
Oh, that has come over time. I believe that the Riverside building was... Well, Aaron was still here.
Yeah.
And the 400 Broadway South was recent. That was a conversation with Brett and I. And then I actually had to make the judgment call on what are clear boundaries that make a tidy map from a consultant's perspective, again, on the Matthew McAndrews building.
I have a question for Brent. It struck me as odd, since the HPC reviewed a draft of this in August, that the HPC wouldn't have been consulted about changing what was reviewed.
Well, this is a draft before you this evening, so that's why we're here to discuss this document. I mean, the commission can make changes to it if you wish.
Would it be possible for you to display the map, and when you're talking about the property, to point them out on the map, please?
I'm actually going to be really honest with you. The woman who did the in-depth study is on maternity leave. So I know your district. I'm not going to be able to, like, I know the buildings. I'm not going to geographically point them out. What I can tell you is what's beneath 4th. I think Brent made a really important point, which is that what I recommend for you is what I can tell you will kind of clear the State Historic Preservation Office with very few hurdles. You have other opportunities to instruct me. So I think that needs to be really, really clear, is that I'm giving you advice based on my understanding of your commercial historic district development and history, and also as a certified local government, what will garner the support of the State Historic Preservation Office.
Thank you.
But the ultimate decision is yours.
Thank you.
I think from staff's perspective is that 4th Street seemed like a good boundary because of the, with the Rosie Adele building being taken down, it left that one property on the west side of Broadway in the district, which would appear to be the district was gerrymandered to include just one property south of 4th Street. So that's why we came to the conclusion that 4th Street was the recommended boundary on the south end of the district. Again, the commission can discuss that, and you can tell or recommend that we put that line somewhere else south of 4th Street.
Okay.
Because ultimately, if the commission wishes to move ahead with this downtown district, it'll come to a hearing before the HPC, and then it'll have to go on to the city council for approval and adoption of a downtown district through the public hearing process.
We're interrupting you.
I know that this is a new process for everyone.
It strikes me that perhaps there's more information you'd like to share with us. We'll become more knowledgeable, and then we'll ask questions. Does that?
I think actually, I think there are questions that you have for me about the district or how district boundaries. I think me telling you how I developed those boundaries, I've got a period of significance that spans actually a pretty substantial amount of time for a local historic district, particularly a commercial historic district. It's spanning from 1870 to 1962. That is a pretty robust period of significance. Rochester is unique in that the commercial trends that you had prior to the Depression and World War II really picked up again after the war. In other cities, you see really dramatic changes that have much to do with urban renewal funding and different kind of like development patterns. And Rochester does something slightly different, which is that you have commercial development starting around the 20s, really around your medical system. And that picks up after the war, and that trend continues. And so you see investment much later that mimics other commercial development prior. That's unusual in urban development. Usually you see something different happen, and you see suburban exodus. And in fact, in Rochester, what you see is downtown commercial development. And that's unique, and that's something that you guys should be proud of. What that means is you actually have a pretty robust period of significance. Usually you see commercial historic districts, and I mean, they're more like 30 to 50 year periods. They're a lot tighter. So you have a unique condition, but you have a unique commercial history, and this reflects that.
The reason you separated it into sort of three segments within that period, because they reflect the kind of changing development patterns that you're
of the city
about.
And of the city's commercial development in particular. And that is common with downtown designation studies to say, here are the trends and here are the buildings within the district that represent those trends. You have three distinct sort of periods, but they all work in a fluid way that is unusual in other cities. You don't have the post-war disinvestment.
Don't have what?
The post-war disinvestment in your urban core.
Does anyone have some questions for Tamara? Am I saying that?
Tamara.
Well, are you going to? I have some other questions about specific properties, but I don't know if you want to finish everything or you want us to just go into the questions.
I think we might accomplish more if I answer your questions than, because I think you're going to have those questions anyway. So.
Okay. One question about the Payne Furniture Store. That building in some shipo material, they referred to it as Second French Empire. They said it was one of the top buildings of that type. In your material, they refer to it as Italianate style. I'm just wondering why the difference.
Oh, they are of a similar period. French Empire is really largely dictated by roof form and shape. And if you have other design elements that... So kind of the hard truth about Victorian era architecture is that, particularly Victorian area, commercial architecture is, I would say there's not one true, it's very rare that one is a true representation of style, and instead you shop a little bit like, here's what looks great, and here's what might draw customers. And so I would say they aren't as far apart as you might think that they are.
It's just that SHPO had specifically mentioned in their letter about that particular building that it was one of the top two examples in the whole state of that style.
Okay. So, well, I will definitely make a note to review. Do you have that? What's the date of that letter?
I don't have that.
Okay.
We could find that if you absolutely need that.
No, that's okay. It's just always useful for us to know.
The other thing is, I know you took out the Riverside building, but on page, I think it was page 23, you specifically listed.
I did catch that there was a building in the narrative that wasn't removed after right. We were asked to remove it from the boundaries.
Right. So, and you could also probably, couldn't you choose if you wanted to, include half a block on that side of the street, although as opposed to go south, like you do go north, for example, onto 2nd Street, you go across the street to include part of that block. So I'm not quite sure why you couldn't go south a half a block the same way you went north a half a block on 2nd.
So,
is there any rationale for why you could do one and not the other?
So there is a rationale when you draw district boundaries, and again, it comes back to how many gaps you have in your space. So when you get to a point, and I hear what you're saying, and I will review those boundary lines, but when you get to a point where you have a scattering of too many non-contributing properties, you have that same challenge of it starts to look cobbled together. And so what I want to make sure that when I look at the boundaries that you're suggesting is that there aren't too many buildings that don't fit our pattern, or there's not a pattern of, I mean, because unfortunately when buildings are demolished, that creates boundary problems too at some point. So I want to make sure that this isn't an area that's impacted in that way.
In the case of the Riverside building, that's the only building that's on that side of the bridge, so there's not a lot of non-contributing properties that are on that side of Broadway
right
next to it. That's the only one.
And I would say with respect to the Riverside building, that's a question that I need you to speak to city staff about, because I removed it at their direction. I removed it at Aaron's direction, and that's what I was instructed to do.
All right, so is there someone from city staff who can explain why it was asked that it be removed?
Probably just because of the way the boundaries would look for the district, because then you would just swoop down to pick up that one building on the south side of 4th Street. So it goes back to that question of having clear and concise boundaries of the district, and it doesn't dip down and pick up one building south of the roadway, would be my guess.
Brent, can you do us the favor of again putting up the boundary map from the August 2017 draft? The one that Gail asked you to put up before.
It's fine. I have.
Or Catch Bunny did.
Well, the one that was in the paper.
And do you have the other boundary on there too? Okay, Brent, I've got both of them on here. It's for the audience.
Just for records, it was in our February 27th HPC meeting. So I found the old, that's where I was going from. I'm sorry, August 22nd,
I think that was August. February's today.
I found the two files. Today's.
It was August when we reviewed it.
Yeah.
And the date on the draft.
This is helpful, it's helpful to look at it and contrast.
Oops. Yes, that one. This again, it makes no sense to me. Given the way this boundary is drawn here, the red is now a vacant lot. And as was just said about the Riverside right across the street, there isn't any other building on that. So I'm sort of looking at this thinking, you know, from the Moss McAndrew building to the Riverside, there's simply one property that would be determined to be non-contributing between them. That doesn't seem like gerrymandering.
Except that we then draw the line just to capture essentially Moss and McAndrews, and we stop following kind of the easternmost boundary line. So it does become a little, from my perspective, and again, it is worth noting that I am making boundary recommendations that make like geographic as well as historical sense, and you can make other choices.
But I think the point is that even in...
The Mossam MacAnders building is also National Register listed,
right.
So I think...
In terms of the way it was written about in the first draft, it's also a significant part of a potential historic district. That's the way it's identified, which to me can strengthen an historic district. And it would be the only property in the potential district which is a National Register listing at this point in time. If I go up above 4th and look at the Francis, which is the small green rectangle that's facing on 4th, you know, it's just there all by its lonesome. And I'm glad it's there, but I can't see that coming south of 4th and having one parcel that's vacant because it's been demolished, I don't see that as gerrymandering. So that's my opinion. Looking north, Ms. Kettlecamp and other people have commented about the Acme Grocery and Time Theater, which that trapezoidal shape that's toward the riverside north of 4th, that's where those two buildings are. And this may be painful to people, but I believe that discussion started occurring because of Bloom Properties and a development application which was in the works and has been moving forward. And again, this is my opinion. The HBC can't backtrack all the time and say, but what about? And I'm I know that's hard to hear. But this historic district didn't start being drafted last year or the year before. So I will give the floor to other people who may wish to comment on the district boundaries.
And I think it's worth noting that if you would like us to explore additional district boundaries, that might be rather than asking me to defend it.
Right. And I understand that.
But
I'm not asking you to defend it. What I need to do is hear from other people.
Right, I hear you.
Yeah. So would anyone else care to speak on this matter?
I would agree with what you said, that extending south to those green properties would be appropriate. So it both makes sense to me. I understand what Aaron maybe said, but we'll just ask them to reevaluate.
I agree with you too. I don't understand why we're stopping there. We've got the Conley Mass on the riverside. Those are important buildings. Did anybody else know?
Not until seeing the map with Chase.
I would just agree with what's been discussed so far. And certainly if it adds to the, you know, the credence of it's already historical. So I don't see why it's not, wouldn't be included when you have, I think, ample evidence to show that it's not gerrymandering.
I know that's a funny word, but...
And I'm not saying that's... I
wait one second, Gail.
I agree with the concept of bringing the boundary across 4th Street. I'm not convinced that we need those two parcels along the river to be added that were shown on previous report.
And I concur with you on that. That's essentially what I said. But it would be good to hear from other people. Mark, you did not comment on that specifically.
Well, where do we stand with that property in terms of its fate? Is it already the Bloom? This is the Bloom development that we're talking about.
The Bloom development is
here. Take it that both things. Is that already approved?
It's scheduled to go to the City Council on March 5th for the summary plan approval.
Next week.
Yeah, next week.
And I'm saying, my opinion to not include those is going to do with the schedule of what's going to City Council and the merit of the buildings that I'm considering.
Gail, I'm sorry, I didn't understand what you meant by that.
The wedge along the river, I'm not concerned that it's out of the new boundary because of the condition of those buildings. But I do think that the boundary should cross 4th Street to pick up Conley Mass and the Riverside building.
Barry?
Yes, I agree with Gail completely about that as far as the boundaries and that we don't have to include what's going to eventually be on the boom properties, mainly because the buildings are, I think, sort of disfigured, you know, compared with what it used to be years ago. So I don't think it maintains its historical integrity, in my opinion. But as far as the Moss McAndrews building, that is such an important part of the commercial property that if it's one thing if its historical designation was based on something else, but it isn't. It's based on the very essence of what this particular district is. So you're leaving out a main contributing element of the district, and I don't really see that. And same with the Riverside building. It's a very important in terms of the commercial, as you yourself said in your own report, those buildings are so important that you can't really leave them out.
So commission giving me instruction to expand district boundaries?
Do we need a vote? Well, I just like sort of consensus right now. I'm not hearing that the trapezoid, we're considering adding that back in. But I need to give a cautionary note here. Those two buildings were not studied further within the report we see. And again, if the HPC commissioners can't refrain from sort of judging anecdotally on the condition of a building
right.
without the expert report, I think we're doing ourselves a disservice. So my point is, given where we are in an application process, for that reason, I understand why those were recommended for removal. And I'm not sure if everyone is in consent with the removal of those.
When you say application process, you're talking about the application of Bloom properties?
I'm talking about the Bloom properties.
Okay,
it's
one of
the
yeah.
Yeah. Would anyone else care to speak on this?
I did have a question about, so you have a draft. I mean, we're making a suggestion here, which would go back and make an iteration, or whatever you'd call it. What other mechanisms? This is the only mechanism to give feedback and ask for updates or changes. Is this the only one?
It was a lot to absorb.
Yes. It's a large district. I think that comes down to your city process and how you proceed with designation. Every city is different in the way that that can be handled.
I would think that if the commission wants us to look at the properties on the south side of 4th Street, that we go back and PVN updates the document, we send it back out to the members, and then I don't know if you want to look at that again at your next meeting, and then if you come to a consensus on that document, then we can look at scheduling a public hearing at a future meeting to establish this district. Go through that process, which again would be a public hearing for the HPC and then also the city council to establish this district.
Thank you. I just wanted to avoid like, oh, next month you come back, here's a new report. Oh, what about, you know, do this other property, and then another month, and oh, another property. And I just want to avoid that iteration. So I just want, yeah, so I don't, cost money, right? So in time, so I'm just trying to be efficient with our time. Mm-hmm. So. You know, we have one recommendation here. Is there a way to, as people can think about it, give Brent other, or do we have to do it right now? You know what I'm saying?
Your question is a very good question, and that's why I was asking you, who know the plan better than we do, even though Laura worked on it much mm-hmm. before you did. Can you give us an overview of things we should be considering carefully?
I will be honest with you. I think that as the city and HPC's historic consultant, who is best as a third-party evaluator, there is a point where me giving you advice on what to pursue starts to blur some boundaries of what is appropriate. Because it sounds like I'm trying to tell you, you know, what, sorry that I'm really struggling with my language here. I want to be very careful. in giving you recommendations on what makes sense as a historic district, either in a draft in August or in a draft in February, we have made those recommendations with respect to expanding the district beyond that. I would say I think we get into a different sort of development history, and that might be a different kind of designation.
Can you hold for 1 second?
Yes.
I don't believe that anyone up here is looking to expand the district boundaries other than the two buildings
okay.
that have just been discussed. Is that... We have consensus on
okay.
that. I'm going to throw out an idea, and
okay.
that is that there's a long period, and within that there are three shorter periods
mm-hmm.
that have a particular quality about them.
Correct.
Can you
mm-hmm.
take a few moments to describe each one, starting
absolutely.
From the oldest, and point out a few buildings that are in it,
I absolutely
why they are in there, so we start to get your vernacular, the vocabulary?
Yes. That.
Does that make sense to people?
No question.
Just let me get the... Does that make sense to people? Okay.
Okay. Very.
No question. I'm just wondering if... I know we've talked about the two buildings on south of 4th Street, but I'm just wondering if anyone else on the commission has any other concerns or issues or that they'd like to bring up today regarding any of the other buildings. At some point in this meeting, I would like to hear if anyone has any comments on any of the other buildings.
As in whether they're contributing or non-contributing?
Right, or if they want to adjust the boundaries by either eliminating some or adding some. Like, cause I don't know if other people have other... I don't, but I don't know if other people have any thoughts or concerns about the other rest of the district.
And I think Barry's point is now's the time to speak. So, I think it will be easier to talk about those after you've given us these periods.
It sounds like this might be useful. So the first thing that I think we want to consider is that you have designation criteria, and we did examine what your designation criteria are, because we both look at buildings and look at commercial history and development, and then we look at how those buildings represent the criteria that are laid forward in your landmark designation process. And the two criteria that made sense for your commercial historic district are criteria A, for the association with the development of the downtown commercial core of the city, which I think that's pretty clear that that's what we're talking about. And criterion H, which really, as it ties to this district, is the representation of the established and familiar characteristics of a commercial district, originally dating to the second half of the 19th century. And in this instance, I would actually expand it to say through the middle of the 20th. So it's important to note that what we have is buildings that represent very specific trends, both in their design, in their function, in the type of business that moved through it. And it's important to note in the way that these buildings served distinct commercial functions over time versus kind of working through a bunch of different uses. Then for a district, you have further criteria that a district needs to be deemed significant for its antiquity. We've taken that to mean at least 50 years of age, which is the National Register guidance and broadly what you adhere to, and criteria B, which is that a district possesses an appropriate degree of integrity of location, setting, design, materials, workmanship, and association given its age. So the chair is correct. There were three sort of broad patterns of history that we saw in Rochester's commercial core, and that created a period of significance that begins in 1870 with early commercial development and ends in 1962, which was kind of a turning point in what I would call like our suburbanization type development here. From 1870 to 1889, that first period, a lot of your commercial development was related to three specific industries: agriculture, milling, and the railroad. And so you see specific buildings, particularly around Broadway and the 300 block and sort of 3rd Street Southwest, if you're looking at your map, like right there, that's your core. And so a vast number of the buildings in the proposed district here are from date to that period. And that begins at 211 Broadway Avenue South, which is just a general commercial building. You have the Clausen and Adler Hardware Store commercial building at 307 Broadway Avenue South, That's a good example. F.J. Payne is a very good example of this period, which is 311 to 313. And I would say those are kind of like key buildings. And then you do move to First Avenue Southwest. You have some commercial buildings and kind of in the 210 to 216, kind of that commercial block. And then you have a couple of buildings at 3rd Street Southwest, specifically 4 and 10, which are also part of that period of early development in Rochester. And that tells a particular story about sort of your early boosterist settling history and the commercial industry that supported that. And I will tell you, that was in some ways, from a historian standpoint, the hardest history to uncover, because there's just not a lot of documentation about Rochester's commercial development prior to the early 1900s. And so the fact that you have so much, like, what we would consider building stock left from that period is really exciting. So that was a really interesting thing to sort of dig into as a historian. The second period of your growth is, Christine?
One request first. I think this would be helpful. If you look at the map that is up there, which just went off, thank you, Brent. Mm-hmm. And we're now back at pretty much this map, except with the removal of the trapezoid. It would be helpful, perhaps, to everyone. I know it would be to me. If there were another map that was coded into period one,
you
period
like
two, period three.
Yes.
Yeah, very much so.
Okay.
And it would also be very helpful to have the addresses, the numbers of the buildings on the map.
Yeah. As a code next to it. Mm-hmm. And that would mean the addresses and the historic name
at least. The historic name.
Yeah. And it may take us a while to understand the historic names, but we will.
I would say that's always the biggest jump when you're used to a building in its present day, to take a 100-year-old name. So I heard we'll color code the map to be periodized and we'll give you addresses and historic names and a key.
That's in addition to this map, not
Correct.
On the same map. Okay.
Right. No, I understand. Yes. Okay.
Does anyone else have a comment yet? A question?
Okay. So the second period is 1890 to 1945. And I will note that this period is, as I said earlier, sort of uniquely broad for Rochester's development because you had different things happening during the Depression and the war than other large cities did. So what really defines this period of time and period of commercial development is that your 1883 tornado kind of changes Rochester. You move from what is, I would say, a typical Minnesota kind of riverfront railroad town to something different with the development of a pretty robust hospital system for a town of its size at that time. So you have the Sisters of St. Francis and the Mayo family, and they're working together, but they also have their own hospitals. And in 1914, with the construction of sort of the first purpose-built Mayo Clinic versus having different offices in different buildings, you see a development in Rochester's downtown commercial core, which is, rather than the sort of speculative, like railroad booster buildings that you have in that first period, you get buildings that are for a very specific purpose, and they are built sort of in response to the people who are beginning to come to town for the medical care. And that's both an early phase of this development, and like other towns and other cities through the Depression and through the war, you don't have as much construction. So that's why it goes through, this period goes through the end of World War II, because in almost every city, what happens after 1945 is a really different story. And so for this period, we see you've got, again, some other commercial, and I actually flipped my buildings. So you get City Hall. So you start to have a little bit of a population boom and your City Hall becomes obsolete and you need a bigger one and a new one. You have some fraternal organizations that start to develop in town and they build purpose-built buildings such as the Oddfellows Lodge 43 building at 23 2nd Street Southwest, because I'm just using historic names, sorry. you have a new professional class, and that leads to the development of a CF Massey company store, which is really different than, say, a dry goods store where people are coming to buy fabric and sort of wholesale goods. But we're starting to get to a little bit of ready-to-wear for men and women, and that's to serve the population that's moving here to both work in hospitals and visit them. So that's just three, because I'm using kind of a lot of your time. And then you have some additional, actually, bank development. As, again, your city starts to grow, you have a new sort of financial investment. So that is a distinct period as far as we're concerned. But again, it's happening, all of that development is happening like between and adjacent to the buildings that were constructed in that first period of time of 1870 to 1889. After World War II, and again, I really want to stress that most commercial historic districts stop at about World War II, and you see something entirely different happen. Rochester continues to develop in its urban core, and its relationship with the hospital systems that exist here continue to expand, and your city continues to both cater to those hospitals and the people coming to them and develop around them. And so you have more hotels being built, you have more restaurants being built, you have very specific stores and theaters, and that's all happening, again, right in this commercial core. And you get the very first branch of the Dayton's department store. So, well, they have their flagship Minneapolis store, and then they could have expanded into St. Paul. They came here, and they put a department store on your main street, which is really, really different than the way that that company will evolve.
What was the date that the Dayton's building?
Let me confirm it, because I always want to say it's 52, and I think it's 55. It's 54, see. what Dayton's will do, essentially, they'll build about two more standalone stores, and then they'll build Southdale. So this is a really unique investment in downtown commercial retail at the exact moment that downtown commercial retail in major flagship department stores is running exactly the other direction, and those stores are failing. So you have a really exciting and unique condition for historians because your downtown commercial development extends well into the 1960s, where in other cities all of that kind of development starts taking place in strip malls at the outside of town, adjacent to federal highways. And so those buildings that date to the post-war period in downtown Rochester extend your period of significance quite dramatically.
Just very quickly, the other ones you gave examples of buildings. So if
in this one, I can. So you have the new Northwestern National Bank at 15 to 21 2nd Street Southeast, and that you also see a branding change in that moment. You have the Dayton's Department Store at 195 Broadway Avenue South. And then there are a couple of commercial buildings on the 300 block of Broadway that represent, they're of earlier construction, but they have a facade update that is pretty consistent with what small towns are doing, small commercial cores are doing throughout the 1940s and 1950s, which is putting, say, structural glass facades or aluminum facades on their building to modernize them and make use of the building stock that exists. And so you do have a couple of buildings that got those mid-century facelifts, and we think that those they can represent two periods, but we think that they really speak well to the way a lot of small business owners responded to modernization in the post-war period. And new materials that allowed you to basically hang a fancier front on an older building or a modern front.
I'm going to ask an odd question.
Yeah.
The gentleman sitting next to me works with IBM.
Mm-hmm.
And I would just ask, the IBM population was also growing.
Yes.
And aside from not being mentioned in our context study, which is, you know, somewhat embarrassing, I would assume the IBM growing population also influenced this, and you haven't mentioned that.
And I haven't, in part because it's not in your context study, and we've been very careful to adhere to the context study you have. I can add that with a recommendation to expand context if that is something that you think would be valuable.
You can't ask me personally, because we haven't had this conversation.
But I think it came up when the work was done in 2014 and 2015. And again, there was some very excellent work done. And as you've learned, Rochester can be a very hard place in which to get the data. So I think it's important. Does anyone else have a comment on that?
It doesn't sound like it would hurt to add a few references to it. Really, that's all you asked me to do.
A major population shift.
Yeah, because it's in the late
50s,
early 60s, significant growth that contributed to people shopping downtown, perhaps.
Yeah, because it wasn't all people who were at Mail. There were people.
Right.
I mean, again,
right. That's
what was different is what you were saying. People were coming into our downtown.
Into your downtown.
Rather than going elsewhere. It wasn't because they worked here or, you know. They were coming in to shop, to eat, to do whatever.
And to travel.
Travel.
You had you have had a large remote, like, traveling itinerant population. Always. Like, after the 20s. So your population numbers ebb and flow based on people who are passing through in a way that is also somewhat unique to Rochester.
And why are they passing? They're here for a period of six months, or they're here?
Or here for a couple of months for employment reasons, government reasons, medical reasons, any number of reasons that you would come stay in a place for 3 months and then leave.
Again, it's the short-term nature of the population changes.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
That have much to do with both Mayo and IBM.
Okay. do we have any other questions? Just stay for a second. Brent and Pat, this, we've reviewed it. As I'm understanding it now, is you will talk with staff about the notion of adding IBM into our study. And I don't know what that will entail, but I trust you'll sort of keep us abreast of it so it can be done reasonably. And then we would get a revised draft as soon as we could.
As soon as you can.
So I would ask that over this next, through this end of this week, that the estimate for when that would be, in terms of a memo about the work order, would occur.
Point of
theory?
Yeah, question. I do think we should get I know most of us seem to want to go below fourth, but I really think we should probably vote on that, just for the record, that we actually do want to have the consultant come back to us with after they explore it, to come back with us with a written comment, rather than just not comment, not have a vote.
I am fine with that, so I'll simply call for a motion.
Okay. I move to have the consultant explore extending the boundary below 4th Street in accordance with the map as originally submitted to in our prior document.
To include specifically the two buildings described.
To include specifically the two buildings described, the Morse McAndrew Building and the Riverside Building.
And requests made tonight?
What do you mean, and requests made? Yes, I'm making a motion tonight. I'm not sure what you mean.
There have been some other, for instance, the map and other things, so...
Yes, and the other requests that have been made throughout the course of the meeting.
All right. Do I have a... Barry, are you... Is that...
Yes, it's a formal
Do I have
motion.
A second? I have a motion from Barry and a second from Valerie. Thank you very much. Any conversation?
I just want to make sure, since we're saying, referencing the other map, that we are not including the two parcels next to the river.
And Dan, what I said was the two buildings discussed, which were the Moss McAndrew and the Riverside.
Right, we're not.
So it's only those two. It's only those two buildings.
Yeah, and I just want to make sure, since Barry referenced the other maps.
I'm specifically excluding the what we call the Bloom properties.
Thank you.
All right. Any further discussion? Hearing none, I'll call the question. All in favor of directing this to proceed by PVN, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Any opposed? Motion carries unanimously. Thank you.
So So do you think we can have it come back like next month or the report? Yeah.
Okay.
I don't know if you're going to stay up here for the revolving loan fund or if Brent's going to cover this. Okay. Going to the next item on our agenda, as I understand it, we had a three-page item in the packet, and Brent has given us some things in copies regarding the revolving loan fund, which we've been asking about for quite some time, and it sounds like it's, I'm not sure if it needs to be this complicated or exactly what's going on.
No, what is, I included the memo from PVN to show us where we've been and where we're going to. And then this evening I included the copy of the original draft that had a bunch of language stricken from Aaron Rees before he left. And then the smaller document is the new version of the document, but with a number of questions from PVN that the stricken language causes to the document. So as shown in there, the memo from PVN, there's about five bullet points listed in their memo that has some conflicts identified in the document based on the stricken language asked for by staff. So my suggestion is that we have the subcommittee look at the revised document and provide us some feedback on that document. And then at some point, the HPC is going to determine what direction the program, is it going to be a grant program or a loan program? And then we also need to establish some requirements of the program, and also we need to secure funding for the program. So those are some of the next steps that, in particular, our office will be looking at a funding source for the program, and we can bring that back to the commission, hopefully at the next meeting, once we are able to establish a funding source for this program. But then in the meantime, I guess I would ask that in addition to our staff looking at the document, we also have the subcommittee established on this, also look at the document and provide any comments back in that document.
Brent, can you, again, the reason it's confused me is that when Aaron finished, which I think was the last day of September, we asked PVN to work on a revolving loan fund, which is obviously not a grant program. and that seemed to have shifted gears. And if there was some guidance by City Council, could you explain that to us?
No, I think there was no guidance by City Council. I'll just back up. Way back in November of 2016 is when Aaron brought the program or the funding request to the City Council. At that time, the City Council tabled the request at that time to establish a funding source for the program. So the Council has not brought that back up to date. So taking that document that Aaron had stricken and talking with PVN, and we're just trying to find a program that's manageable by our staff, something that's simple to monitor and to provide either grants or loans to. So I guess we're looking for some direction. Should it be a grant program or should it be a loan program? So.
Okay, then I'll ask the subcommittee. I don't remember who's on the subcommittee. Do you have that recorded somewhere? There is a benefits and incentives subcommittee. Is that the one you're talking about?
Correct.
Okay, and Jamie agreed to chair that?
Yep.
And who else is on that? Jamie, do you know?
I do not remember.
I'd have to go back and look at the minutes from the September meeting of last year or the November meeting of last year. I know at one point I pulled those out for someone and I sent it to you, I think Christina, as far as the members, but...
Yeah, and
I can find that out. I can email the members on that committee.
Well, and one of the things I'd like to say is, separate from this, came up with Jamie a bit later, I think. It was probably the September meeting where we talked about this, and there are a number of people on this commission who have fiscal experience. And I believe they stated they would be interested in review Again, that's not my expertise.
I have the names up.
Okay, let's hear it.
It was myself, Tom, and Trent. Those are the three names who came forward back in November.
Okay, and Jamie, again, as chair, I'm glad to sit on it just to sort of keep the continuity going with the chair. Tom and Trent, are you up for this? Uh-oh.
It is a busy season.
Trent? Okay. Jamie, so are you good with this? Okay.
So I guess there's really no action for the HPC this evening, but I think just showing that we're looking forward to get this program established, and we'll come back with additional information in the near future on the program and the funding source. So,
the curious thing about this is to move it along. I'm wondering if the subcommittee should meet with you or with somebody in city administration, so we're not sort of operating in separate silos and not collaboratively figuring out where to go.
And that'd be all fine too. Yeah, I'm open to that.
Okay, Jamie, did you catch that? Okay. All right.
Can I ask a question? Okay. I know we don't know exactly how much money we're talking about, but in terms of whether or not we have grants or loans and whatever, what was the size of the amount? What kind of amount of money were we talking about for the financial incentives? Are we talking about $100,000? Are we talking about $3 million or $10 million? Like, what were we talking about?
Oh, back in. When Aaron had brought the original RSC to the council, it was like, at that time, he was thinking $400,000.
What are we thinking now?
Well, we got to figure out the funding source first, so.
Right, but in terms of designing something, it's easier to design something in some ways if you have some clue about how much money you're working with.
I think that's an internal discussion that staff within the city needs to sit down and determine what funds are available for a program for the city. So.
Well, and I see that Mark has had to leave, Mark Builder, back. But he's our liaison to council, essentially, because he attends HPC meetings. I'm in agreement with Barry that we have to have some idea of what the funding source might be and how the council feels about it. So, Jamie, do you have any suggestions on how to work with city staff to figure this out?
I think it makes the most sense to really just get something set up so we can meet in person and start exploring some of the options that we have and go from there.
Okay. So, may I look to you to start setting that up, working with Brent, and then just advising the members?
Yep.
Okay. Brent, does that make sense?
Yep.
Okay.
Fine.
Okay. Thank you very much. All right. We have finished old business. We're now moving on to new business, which is findings of fact, conclusions of law and order on the Days Inn Hotel Carlton. Before we begin this, and again, this is not a public hearing, there was an email that came from Brent this morning with a communication from Mr. McCool representing the owner that I think was like a 4-page memo. Has everyone had a chance to review that? I need affirmation shown. So Jamie has not. So again, in deference to how we work this with the late order, Jamie, can you take a quick, it's about 4 pages. Do you think 5 minutes will be sufficient? All right, thank you. Now, there's a phrase for this. I can't remember what it's in Robert's Rules. Aren't you glad I'm reading Robert's Rules? Stand at ease. That means I can just call it because no one's up in a stitch about it. So we're going to stand at ease for 5 to 10 minutes, and people may leave the dais, have conversations. If you do have a conversation, you need to put your mic down. I've got it right here. Thank you.
project that actually works.
A stress fracture, and so he was sent to another fort to recuperate. So we're going to go out and visit him next weekend. Next weekend, the 9th, we're going to go out and see him there and see how he's doing. Yeah, so he's been reassigned. Not sure what's going to happen with the airborne ranger. Not sure about anything.
Stress
factor.
Pardon? They don't know how quickly the stress factor.
About 4 months.
Yeah,
it's a long time. And that's just not easy to do in the Army. They will assign him some lighter duty things, maybe even change his, they call it an MOS, so some change what he's there for, which will be very, very exciting. So we're going to go see him, see how he's doing. Just kind of.
Yeah.
Yeah. I heard Terry, and now he's not sure what's going to happen. I mean, some people, you know, if it doesn't heal, doesn't, you know, and I can see where it wouldn't if you're continuing, you're enlisted, you have to do something. So I can see where some people get a medical discharge because they never heal. If it goes to 6 months, could he just make it a medical discharge?
People I know in the service, and I have,
but at the same time, they know that airborne rangers are probably the worst for not reporting illnesses or not reporting, which is what happened. He didn't want to report. He was doing the he was getting ready to jump out of the plane, sort of thing, and so they had some things that they were doing, and he was able to keep up, and they said. So he's running around with 100 pounds of gear on, saying, why can't you keep up, and what is going on? And he said, okay, well, I've got this pain in my knee. That doesn't seem to go away. So they sent him in to be evaluated, and that's how they made it. Otherwise, you know, he was keeping up, and they put on full gear ready to jump from the high towers, and then they do this thing, and then he just was not able to keep up. Noticed he was limping.
Yeah, one of my brothers was in the 82nd Airborne.
Oh, she was.
Yeah.
Yes.
Well,
we've done.
But
I hope to see him soon.
Yeah.
I have to be there. Head care, staff doctor, I'm a nurse, so we can't be there. They're not doing things the way they should right away. So, you know. Yeah.
Okay. So you'll take the time to go see him.
We're now moving on to findings of fact, conclusions of law and order, days in Hotel Carlton. Jamie has now reviewed the email that was received this morning. I'm going to ask, are there any people who wish to abstain or recuse themselves from this discussion? It's not a public hearing. Asking, none speaking. I'd like to comment, and again, I haven't reviewed this with Pat Alfredson. Our job here is to review the draft PDF, conclusions of law and order on the matter of the hotel considered, to determine if it accurately summarizes the basis of evidence on which the HPC found for local landmark designation to recommend to City Council for the Days Inn Hotel Carlton. We may accept as drafted. We may make clarifications, corrections, additions, deletions as determined necessary. We may reject as not a reflective summary of the basis of the evidence. Just to let you know that this is our call. Pat has simply drafted what she believes best reflects our votes on in the January meeting. Pat, I'd like to ask you if you could please, because this is new for us, could you give the commissioners any other overview of this to guide us in this process?
Well, first of all, I will take no offense at any kind of deletions, changes, corrections, whatever you may find. Our meeting went 3.5 hours, and we didn't get into any direction for me. So what I did is I went through the tape and my notes that I had from the meeting to try to summarize what was being stated at the meeting. If you feel that something is mischaracterized, we should correct that. If you believe something was included and there was something that is incorrect, inaccurate, we need to correct that, delete that. But basically, the findings of fact would be points that you were specifically pointing out, evidence, testimony, exhibits, things of that nature that you found significant that led you to your conclusion. I believe that Valerie Gomez was the one, the commissioner, that started with a motion. There was a lot of discussion. The motion was amended. There was more discussion. And so that's what I tried to incorporate in the findings of fact to get to your conclusion of law. Again, I'm at your direction here. This is your document.
So it says prepared by Brent, but it was really written by you, Captain?
I just prepared the cover memo.
I see.
In the document.
Okay.
The
document. I wasn't sure. That's fine. Thank you. Just curious.
All right. I'll get this started. Brent, on the flash drive that I gave you, there's a PDF that should be titled Notes on This. And to sort of get this started, I went through the document and I have what I consider 6 minor corrections that I'd like to recommend. And staff will have that PDF file. And I tried to do it, again, if this doesn't work for you, let me know, but to try to figure out how we do this. So it's number 1 through number 6 is the 6 minor corrections. Number 1 is on page 1 of the draft from Pat, and it's the second full paragraph, and then I try to give what it begins with to make sure we know what we're speaking of. So it's this second full paragraph beginning with on December 6, 2016. After 19.04, which ends this paragraph, this paragraph references action by the HTC on December 6th in 2016. 3 members who are now present, Dan Brodeber, Valerie, and myself, were members of the commission at that point. And Pat, I believe that it should, and I don't know that this writing is the best, but it should reference the fact that it was acted on under Ordinance 19B and placed before the council action on November 7th and December 5th, 2016. So that it's clear what ordinance base was the basis for the public hearing. Valerie, does that make sense to you?
It does make sense. And I think because I have 1903 and 1904, it's in 19B03 and 19B04. I thought it was inherent, but I will change it however you would like.
I'm not trying to complicate life.
No.
I think it probably should be clear because 19B just sort of floats for people. But I will trust. I am noting these. I will not be making a motion, obviously, as chair. I just started start getting some things out there so people could be aware of how they might be looking at this. Number two is the first full paragraph on page two, which begins with, on April 25th, 2017, after May 23rd, 2017, there's a period, and Pat, there's no, in other sections, you note why the hearing didn't happen, and there's no mention here of what was the cause for the hearing not to be held on that date. So I believe that note should be added. And I wasn't going to paraphrase for it, so I simply put that comment in italics and parentheses. Minor correction number three is on page four, between item six and item seven at the top of the page. I would recommend inserting an additional finding and renumber from here forward for 12 total findings of fact. And I will simply call this added and will not renumber any at this time. And what lies below it is you've referenced in item seven. One of the things that I took away very much from, and that Valerie spoke of at some length and a number of times, was the importance of our use of experts to assist the HPC. And we've referenced the SHPO memo from Michael Koop, and that's one document, not two. It's Michael Koop's SHPO memo. But we did not reference, which we referred to that night, PVN's November 22nd memo, which included draft findings and a conclusion. So I'm not going to read this out loud, if people could just take a moment to read it. And Valerie, I look particularly to you because that was something that you made very important in your...
Yeah, and that was what I was referencing.
Okay. On page five, number four, which doesn't make any sense. Oh, number four. Oh, it's correction number four. I apologize. On page five, between the second full paragraph, between the second full paragraph ending with discussion of the hotel's location, and eight, and adding a paragraph under seven. So seven would have another paragraph below location. And that comes from the discussion of, in the conversations we had that night, the HBC, again, I'll ask you to take a look at that. Number five is on page five. And Pat, this is I believe I'm the person who said this, and it's not reading as I intended it, but I may have misspoken. So I took paragraph nine, and the only thing that's changed is what's in italics, underlined in bold. It may be developed into a boutique hotel or the current hotel demolished, as is there, and then insert whether or not it is designated as landmark property. And item correction number six on page seven follows from about the SHPO letter and the PVN memo. And it just takes SHPO out of one location in that paragraph and puts it after Michael Koop's SHPO letter to Aaron Reeves, dated July 17th. And then it goes on to add in PVN's memo of November 22nd, 2017. Thank you.
there anyone will let us know when you're done sort of scanning through this common spaces? Is there anything anyone needs clarification on or comment, or how are we doing? Well, the question would be, you know, would someone like to motion to amend based on these suggested edits, or would you rather let's hear from everybody and try to get them all in one place? Harry?
I'm comfortable just to put it on the floor for to move it forward. I'm comfortable making a motion to approve the edits that you suggested.
Okay. Is that okay with people? All right. Do I have a motion?
I just made a motion.
No, you didn't.
Yes, I said I'd like to make a motion to approve the edits.
All right. As presented and as the PDF, which is in the public record. I have a motion. Do I have a second? I have a motion by Barry, a second by Ms. Beebe. Any discussion? Hearing none. All in favor? Aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Motion carries unanimously. Is there further conversation about this document? Based on what I outlined at the beginning of opening this up. Mr. Skolnick?
You know, I sort of hate to bring it up, but I will. And the memo that that Mr. McCool sent to Mr. Svendi, he says in paragraph 2, what concludes the law, that the HPC does not and may not make conclusions of the law. So I guess my question is, is it standard practice for commissions and boards to actually include that in the wording of what's submitted? Is that standard practice, or is that unusual for us to do that?
Yes. It was an or.
Yes or yes. I mean.
Because I wouldn't want to do anything to specifically violate the law. If we've never done it before and it's illegal, I obviously wouldn't want to do it. So your office's position is that it's okay to do that.
This is what Terry Atkins asked me to propose to the group and to draft. And when I look at the city attorney that is currently in office, he indicates, yes, this is what is done.
And the second question is the Ginger Carroll memo. It wasn't in the motion, it was in the testimony. It was not in the motion that Valerie made. He seems to be implying that It was not part of the motion that was ultimately voted and approved. Now, it wasn't part of the motion, but it was part of the testimony. So is it improper to include that in a findings of fact if it wasn't part of the motion, even though it was part of the testimony?
What I recall and what I heard Commissioner Gamarra say is that I am basing my motion based on everything that's in the packet, everything we've heard tonight, etc. And so when that had been discussed on the record, I thought that she was including that in her motion. If that is not accurate, I am willing to change it to reflect what is accurate for this group.
Well, okay, so I was basing it on what was in our package. So, I mean, that was everything.
The packet and the testimony during the public hearing.
I mean, we have to consider all of this information in our study, and that is what I did. Now, was it reflected in the motion? I don't recall. I'm basing it on all of the testimony, everything that we have heard. In particular, the person sitting on the audience, I remember the testimony, and that was very persuasive. And so, do I need to single each one out? I remember asking that question, too. Do I need to state everything that I'm basing my decision upon? And I didn't feel like I had to.
Well, and I think we looked to legal counsel.
Yeah, so
you can base your motion based on what's in the public record. However, if it appears that I emphasized something or characterized it in a way that is not accurate, I want to change it to reflect what the HPC wants in the findings.
So can you say that one more time, just to give everybody a chance to...
I want to accurately reflect what the HPC intended. And so I think you're looking at number 10, correct? Mr. Skolnick, you brought this up first, right?
Yes.
Are you looking at number 10?
Yes.
Yeah. We're to Mr. McCool's letter, is that what we're at?
No,
number
10
is part of the findings of fact document. I only was referencing the fact that it was McCool's letter said because it wasn't specifically part of the motion, and my understanding of his letter is that he couldn't include it in the findings of fact. Now, you're saying that going as part of the testimony, you can include it in the findings of fact. It didn't have to specifically be spelled out in the motion.
That is what I am telling you.
Right. Okay, that's fine. Okay, I just wanted to bring it up since we have to vote on this tonight. I just wanted to make sure that we had a proper understanding, at least from our standpoint.
Thank you for bringing up the question.
But if you review 10 and you want something changed in that, now is the time to voice that.
I really do think that 10 accurately represents what we discussed with regard to that written testimony. So.
Okay. Yes, no, I'm satisfied with those answers. I just wanted to bring it up because I felt for us to vote on it without bringing it up.
I have a question to understand the finding, in fact. And my understanding is that based on all of the, even though I wasn't at the meeting, so I want to be clear since we're on new business right now, that the vote was on two criteria. So is the finding in fact the two criteria that the vote was on, or the finding, in fact, happened to be everything that happened to be discussed in a three-hour meeting? Because it seems like the findings, in fact, have gotten larger than the scope of what the two criteria were that was voted on. And I'm asking the question so I understand, because I wasn't at the meeting, so I'm kind of in the slippery slope of talking and voting on new business based on something that is... that I wasn't attending it, but I need to understand that it just seems like the criteria has gotten longer and longer, based more, it's gotten a little cloudy, in my opinion, from what I've understood that the two criteria that got the vote and the finding of fact.
I'm going to let Valerie answer that if you can, because it was your motion, but it was beyond, it covered things beyond those two criteria, because there was much more information data presented within the packet
and it was amended, you know, so yeah, but basically referencing that piece of information was showed that this was historic, is of local historic significance. And so for me, it met that criteria, and that it was very important to Rochester's history. And so that's why I referenced it, along with testimony that was given. And so I'm not sure, you know, why the focus on the Carroll memo, when there was testimony given, that was included in the motion.
Yeah, and I want to make sure you understand, I'm not just looking at that memo as we go through all of the findings. In fact, it just seems to go past the two criteria that seem to be the vote that moved it forward. And I understand there was a lot of discussion and a lot of information brought out there, but I'm not sure that just because there was discussion on it that it was a finding and a fact. When the commission voted on two criteria that had criteria for findings of fact that were outside of some of the things that may be put in the scope, that may be go into different criteria, but it was discussed that evening. I understand that.
We can hear anything that is brought before us that night,
correct,
and consider whether or not it has importance for this particular, in this case, a building. It doesn't take away the sort of preliminary of the two criteria that were identified by our experts as the thing to look at, and within context and within this period of significance. And now we're not limited by what we can include as guiding a vote, whether it was for or against it.
You can pare this down, or you can add more to it. There was a long discussion, and I thought that part of this was not everyone agreeing that's on the commission to certain things, but that certain aspects were discussed, and that the findings of fact would reflect that for a city council person that picked this up, wondering, well, I wonder if the commission considered this or if they considered that. However, again, if you want to make changes to this document, I can do that.
Any other questions, comments? Say I would entertain a motion. Pat, we need to actually vote on this, correct?
Yes, for the changes. So I can make these changes and submit it to the chair. I don't know if you want to review another draft.
Another draft.
I have a question for Pat. I don't know if you really. So, is it customary? So, I voted against. So I asked, what's the way to provide a dissenting opinion? It's not in here. Is it that's not customary? What would be if I wanted to express my concerns, my opinion to the city? What's the best mechanism to do that? Is it just a letter to the city council of my own?
Anybody in the community can make a statement to city council. When you're on the commission, I ask that you
specifically state, I'm not speaking on behalf of the commission
right.
or expressing that the commission agrees with what I have to say. But whether you do that verbally or in writing, that's up to you.
Okay. And the second question would be, is it customary? So here we're adopting a finding of facts that I don't necessarily agree with, right? I mean, I've already expressed that. It would be, I would think, customary for me not to vote for that. I mean, is that a fair thing? Does that make sense? If I was to say, oh, yeah, here's the findings of facts, I approve them, that's contrary to how I voted on the matter that led to the findings of facts. Does that make sense?
It does.
Okay. That's why I'm not making a motion.
So let someone else make the motion. Who cares about it? I just want to explain that. I'm sitting here quiet and you're looking at me.
You know, because this is our first time reviewing a document like this, I wonder if we shouldn't err on the side of caution and take a look at another draft before we make any formal, take any formal action.
I understand that point of view.
The only thing is that, frankly, we don't always get a full house, or we sometimes barely get over a quorum, and I'm just concerned about that. So I would almost rather move the document and just have it approved subject to the chair's review. But that's my view. But I don't know if others agree with that or not.
I guess I wonder if there's any hardship put on the ownership of this property by kind of sitting in limbo, not knowing what that designation is. I mean, even if they weren't planning on doing anything with it real estate-wise, just sitting in limbo is kind of a stress and a hardship. And it is a recommendation, the final designation goes to City Council, is that correct?
Motion that we accept this document with the changes that are suggested here, and the way someone voted in my mind doesn't impact whether or not they vote that this is an accurate representation of what happened at the meeting. So I think that this is an accurate representation. So I would make the motion that we accept it along with these changes.
All right. I have a motion by Ms. Eady.
I have a second.
I have a second by your right. any discussion? Hearing none, all in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Could we have that hands raised, please? All opposed? That brings us to, I don't believe there are any other matters for us to review, unless staff has something that we need to cover with us.
I have no further to say.
Thank you very much for putting this together. Do I have a motion to adjourn?
Motion to adjourn.
Thank you. Do I have a second?
A second.
Thank everyone in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Right.
It's just a
right.
Right.
Right.